You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for September 18th, 2015. This week, I'm going to talk about the announcement of the SPRINT trial and blood pressure targets, the ABIM, seeing frailty in our patients who are coming for cardiac procedures, and the amazing effects of exercise, especially in diabetics. One of the biggest problems in all of cardiovascular medicine today is knowing the ideal blood pressure. Just 2 years ago, the 8th Joint National Commission on Blood Pressure departed from the guidelines and they relaxed blood pressure targets. Now, why did they do this? My read of that was that when they looked critically at the evidence, they couldn't find significant evidence for benefit, especially in subgroups like the elderly. This may, and I emphasize may, have changed this week with the announcement of the SPRINT trial, which was an NIH-funded trial. In an immensely strange turn of events, the investigators of SPRINT released to the world through press conference and a press release that more stringent blood pressure control is beneficial. And I say immensely strange because there were no trial results given. We just heard the conclusions. So to review, the SPRINT trial is a randomized controlled trial that randomized more than 9,000 patients in 100 centers in the U.S. and Puerto Rico to one of two arms, either a strict or stringent blood pressure control using 120 millimeters, or the other group was 140 millimeters goal. These were high-risk patients with at least one cardiovascular risk factor and or pre-existing kidney disease. Now, at this point in the podcast, I would normally tell you the results of the trial, but again, as I said, all we know is conclusions. We learned in the press conference that there was nearly a 30% relative reduction in cardiovascular events and a 25% reduction in mortality, relative again. We learned the trial was terminated early because of positive results. And we also heard words like practice-changing, paradigm-changing, and life-saving. Now, there's a lot to say about this, but let's start with the fact that this trial hasn't been presented at a meeting. It hasn't been published in a journal, so it hasn't undergone any peer review. We also know that when you report results in relative terms, it's a good way to exaggerate the benefits. I mean, we need to know patient characteristics, the absolute numbers of events. How else do we determine the number needed to treat if we don't know how many events there were in each arm? We don't know anything about subgroups, so it's hard to individualize or generalize this data to a wide swath of patients with hypertension. Most importantly, we don't know about any adverse events. We don't know about potential harms. And nothing in the press conference or nothing I read was said about the potential dangers of terminating a trial early in terms of introducing bias. I'm not a statistician, and I can't go on about that, but I know it's significant. This is a really weird story. I've read a lot of mainstream media stories on this, and they're universally positive and glowing, and yet there's just no results. There's so much hype in healthcare already, and I don't understand this, and I'm really worried about this turn of events. Some of the most interesting things that I've read about this and the most truthful things I've read about this have actually come from physician blogs. So, of course, I'm biased when it comes to blogging, but to me it seems like the blogosphere has definitely outdone mainstream media in terms of its candor on this. Again, I'm not saying the trial is negative, and I don't know. That's the point, is we'll have to wait to see the results. But without the results, it's hard to put this into context. Let's move on to news from the ABIM. 168 comments in the last 24 hours. That shows the interest in Robert Lowe's Medscape medical news story on the new announcement from ABIM. Really, it's yet another concession from ABIM. I should say a possible concession, because ABIM says it will consider the recommendation of the, quote, Assessment 2020 Task Force to replace the 10-year high-stakes exam with more frequent modular-type exams that are more continuous. Some of these modular exams would almost certainly be open book exams. So this announcement comes 1 week after the American Board of Anesthesiology said it was foregoing its 10-year exam for online testing. Getting rid of this secure, high-stakes exam is a really big deal, especially since continuous exams would also forego the self-assessment part of the MOC. So in recent months, just to review, we've seen some big changes from ABIM. This isn't all, right? We heard recently that specialists like myself, electrophysiologists, we're not going to have to certify in both cardiology and the specialty. Just certifying in your specialty alone was going to be enough. That's really big for me, because the cardiology board exams would be much harder than electrophysiology. The other thing that we heard from ABIM is that the onerous practice improvement modules and things like patient safety module requirements were also going to at least be put on hold. Even the ACC sent out a statement saying they strongly agreed with these changes. That's pretty big, too. Dr. Barron said in the news story that this is a different ABIM. So if all these changes actually do occur, or if they're actually implemented, it'd be really hard to disagree with Dr. Barron. But here's the thing. ABIM has amassed a tremendous amount of acrimony in the physician community. I mean, you can tell that in the comments. Not all of them were negative, but most of them were. So it just remains to be seen how this is going to play out. Certainly an interesting story and a popular story. So next up, I want to move to the challenge for cardiologists in 2015. The challenge for us now is rarely about having something to do for patients. It's whether we should do it. I mean, when I first started training, we didn't have a lot of these things we have now. And here's what happens to me so often. Patient's 80 years old, comes from the nursing home, was doing pretty well at the nursing home, but not much. Then they go into atrial flutter. So now what? Are we really going to perform catheter ablation? On the one hand, we don't want a nursing home patient to suffer with atrial flutter. But on the other hand, when you start doing things to people who are frail, sometimes it doesn't end well. So to get us closest to what we call right care requires a vision of our patients as a total human being, not as an ECG change or troponin rise or a rhythm problem. And this is why I love a recent analysis of PCI outcomes based on a simple-to-use frailty scale. Now, frailty is always going to be a bit subjective, but what these investigators from Sheffield, UK, did was they used this qualitative or descriptive Canadian study of health and aging clinical frailty scale. The scale goes from 1 to 9. It's very qualitative. It's very descriptive. But the researchers decided that anything above a score of 5 was going to be frail, and anything from 1 to 4 was non-frail. And not surprisingly, here are the results. Being frail increased the 30-day mortality by a factor of 5. Almost 5% of patients who had PCI who had a score of more than 5 ended up dead at 30 days. But what was even, I think, more interesting was that age was not a predictor, but frailty was. So this may not be a randomized controlled trial. It was published in BMJ Heart Journal, which is an open access journal. That's nice. But yet, I think it's a really important study, because we have to start seeing frailty in our patients, and we have to start thinking about what is the mortality with our intervention and what is the mortality without our intervention. And when we think in those terms, that in frail patients, it's often the same. I think seeing frailty helps us better advise and counsel our patients about whether we should proceed in the first place. Finally, I want to talk about the value of exercise as a therapy. So there's been a lot of news recently about diabetes. ESC had a ton of information about diabetes. But most of this news entails medications not harming the heart. So that says a lot, right? A study on diabetes medications is considered positive if there's no cardiac harm. So the point being is that patients with diabetes who suffer a lot of cardiac complications don't have a lot of good treatment options. But that may be because we're always thinking or equating treatment with medications. A recent study, small number of patients, but a clinical trial nonetheless of type 2 diabetes medicines, diabetes patients, showed that high-intensity exercise had pretty dramatic effects on the heart. So a group from Newcastle, UK, took type 2 diabetes patients and they compared one group, control group, standard care. Another group got a multi-week training program with high-intensity interval training. And they did MRI scans on these patients afterwards, and they showed that compared to controls, HIIT training did a lot. It had changed in physiologic hypertrophy, increased stroke volume, increased ejection fraction, and improved diastolic filling. It even had a nice non-cardiac side effect in that patients or the subjects who did the HIIT had a marked reduction in liver fat. So, look, I don't think we need to be preachy about exercise to all patients or patients who are not doing well. But if a patient presents with a problem or they present with a disease and we're treating it, we should think about exercise as a potential therapy. We should look at studies like this. We should do more studies looking at exercise as a potential therapy. I mean, look at the CardioFit trial for atrial fibrillation. I mean, here, a gain in two METs helped reduce atrial fibrillation burden. So I think of exercise as a potential therapeutic option as much as I do a prevention. So that's it for this week in cardiology. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.